Well, howdy there, stranger. I'm Jordy.
And I'm Brad.
And welcome back to Beers with Queers, the true crime podcast where I research a case, and Brad here, and potentially you guys,
don't know a damn thing about it.
So first off, I want to start off by saying I apologize if I sound stuffy or congested. We just got back from almost a week in Washington, D.C. for a friend's birthday, and one of the souvenirs that I brought back with me was a cold or something, but I have been stopped up. So I'm sorry if my voice sounds really congested or really deep. We're going to power through it, and I'm going to do the best I can. But other than that, the D.C. trip was great. Thank you to all you that recommended places to go and visit. We found a lot of really cool and unique gay bars while we were there. There were Trade, the Little Gay Pub,
Uproar,
which is a bear bar, and then probably the best one of all of them, it was called the Green Lantern, and it was unlike anything I've ever experienced before. When we walked in after about 10 minutes, we literally said, we don't have nothing like this in Tennessee. So it was definitely a fun experience. We got to see all the museums, the zoo, and all that. So
definitely two country boys in the big city.
Very much it was two country boys in the big city. And that's exactly what it felt like. But it was a fun time. We got to ride the metro. So if you can't make it out to D.C., highly recommend it because all the museums are so fun, so informative.
And don't skip the Holocaust Museum, even if you think it's going to be a rough time, and it is, it's really worth going to.
It is, and I'm actually going to post a story when I post this episode, but I took a few videos and stuff from the Holocaust Museum when we went, covering the pink triangles and stuff like that. So it is, of course, really hard and a really big downer, but it is important to remember and to see it, I think, and so you have to go at least once.
And plus, there's so many people out there now, like 30% of Gen Z doesn't believe in the Holocaust anymore.
Yeah, I actually read a study last week, and I shared it with Brad here. It was something like the number of people who don't believe the Holocaust happened or believe it wasn't as bad as how it's portrayed is actually on the rise instead of decreasing, which is very concerning. So if you have any doubt about the Holocaust, visit the Holocaust Museum in D.C., and you will be, it's very sobering.
It's an unflinching look, but it really needs to be that way to drive home just the cost of what the Holocaust brought to everyone involved.
Yeah, millions of people. So, highly recommend you check out D.C., and with that, something else happened last week that I'm sure a lot of people, if you didn't see it, you at least know it happened. So I'm sure a lot of you have heard of the Oscars or the Academy Awards, and this is going to be a case actually that I don't think a lot of people know about or have heard of until last week. So if you are familiar with the Academy Awards, you may have watched the 96th Academy Awards that aired on March 10th, 2024. Now, of course, I won't spoil all the winners just in case y'all want to go and find out for yourselves. But there was definitely a few surprises in there. Some movies I thought would win more, didn't win as many, or none at all. And some I suspected of taking home quite a few, but definitely not as many as they did, end up taking a crap ton home. So it was an all-around good evening. However, like every year, there's always at least one or two Oscar moments that managed to penetrate the internet zeitgeist and become the moments that essentially define that year's Oscars. You know, last year we had Will Smith slapping Chris Rock. I remember in 2014, we had the Ellen selfie with all the biggest A-listers at the time. We had at the 2018 Oscars, the infamous moment when La La Land was accidentally read as Best Picture instead of Moonlight, who was the true winner. So there's always a moment or two that gets talked about more than anything else that happened that night. And this year's moment came from a very unexpected place. So when presenting the award for Best Costume Design, John Cena was brought on stage to help host Jimmy Kimmel. And right off the bat, he caught everyone's attention because he seemed to walk out on stage completely nude. Now, the only thing protecting his manhood from showing was the envelope which held the winner of the award in it. So, of course, he wasn't actually naked. He was wearing a skin-colored thong sort of contraption that covered his crotch and his butt. But it got a few good laughs and really took off on the internet afterwards. Of course, most of the memes were just admiring how amazing John Cena's body was, because it is. But it also sparked a bit of a debate about how things like that are acceptable at the Oscars, but potentially, you know, having something like a drag queen on presenting an award would probably be more controversial, which I'm not saying that's not wrong. But those are two sides of the meme that I'm seeing on my feed, at least. I don't know if y'all are seeing any different types of meme with that, but if you are, let us know. But either way, the conversations were buzzing about it, and it was the clear standout moment from this year's Oscars. Now, Jimmy himself mentions before the skit begins about how it was inspired by possibly the most infamous moment in Academy Awards history. So he talks about how at the 46 Academy Awards back in 1974, that a man ran across the stage on live television in the midst of an award presentation. I'm talking full on display, flopping around as he ran up behind the host and then off stage, and it quickly became the defining moment of that year's Oscars, and possibly one of the most memorable moments, period.
In the Oscars history.
In the Oscars history. Now, Jimmy never refers to this streaker by name, and most people who are already familiar with the streaking incident probably won't be able to tell you who his name was either. He's simply known as the Academy Awards streaker. Since the 2024 Oscars, a whole new generation is rediscovering the streaking incident in all of its glory with clips easily found on YouTube. It's brief, but its impact is huge. So today we're going to be talking about the man behind the streaking and help you in discovering the amazing man that was Robert Opel, a.k.a. the Academy Awards streaker. Now, what many people don't know is that Robert was more than just a random nudist trying to cause a commotion or get his 15 minutes of fame. He was a proud bisexual man who for years dedicated his life to helping and supporting the queer community of San Francisco during the early years of the gay liberation movement all the way up until his untimely murder.
I was fixing to say, he must meet an untimely end to make it onto our podcast, unfortunately.
That is true. Sadly, this story doesn't have a happy ending. Robert lived a colorful life, and you're about to find out he is the very definition of a larger-than-life character. But this is a true crime podcast, and of course we know it doesn't end well. But his story is very fascinating nonetheless. It's April 2nd, 1974, and the night everyone in Hollywood waits for each year. The 46th Annual Academy Awards was being held that evening at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion in Los Angeles, California. Now, I think most people are familiar with what the Oscars are at this point, but if you are not, basically, it's just considered to be the top awards in the field of the film industry, the best of the best. If a person or a film has an Academy Award winner in front of it, it's considered to be one of the must-see films of the year. You know, it's the award that anyone involved with filmmaking will tell you. At some point in their life, they've had a dream of one day walking across that stage and winning an Oscar. You know, as an amateur filmmaker myself, I have that dream. So it's something we all share. And that's the reason it is nicknamed the biggest night in Hollywood. Now, amongst those present at this ceremony were the hosts of the awards, which included Burt Reynolds, Diana Ross, John Huston, and David Niven. By this point, old Hollywood had died out around 1969 with the death of the Hays Code restrictions on movies, and an era known as New Hollywood was ushered in and firmly cemented itself by 1974. So this ceremony offered kind of a unique blend of old Hollywood stars and new Hollywood stars, which was a huge deal since now you kind of associate the two with being very distinct and separate periods in movie history. So this was that sweet spot in the middle where they kind of blend together and connect. And I'm talking people from Liz Taylor, Ingmar Bergman, to newcomers to the scene like Francis Ford Coppola, and even a pretty little-known creator named George Lucas, who attended the ceremony for his very first nomination for American Graffiti. The Exorcist was tied for most nominations that night with The Sting. Linda Blair was in attendance at just 12, having been nominated for her role in The Exorcist. So the night had gone pretty smoothly and uneventful, as all the awards were given out without any notable incident. Only one last award was left to announce, and that was the award for Best Picture. Host David Niven took the stage and began to introduce Elizabeth Taylor as the presenter for Best Picture. As Liz began to make her way to the stage, David was making a small speech about how, quote-unquote, the world at the moment is having a bit of a nervous breakdown, and film offers us an escape from that reality. Now, as David had his back to the stage, he did not see what the audience saw as a commotion began to sweep over them. Finally, turning to see what was up, that's when a man with shaggy long hair and a thick mustache came trotting out from behind a backstage curtain towards stage right. The man is fully nude and says nothing as he runs past David, flashing a peace sign at the camera before turning and running off stage. The entire thing lasts about 10 seconds. So I'll actually play a clip here from that very moment, and I'll let y'all hear not only the crowd's reaction, but also David's response.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that was almost bound to happen. But isn't it fascinating that... fascinating to think that probably the only laugh that man will ever get in his life is by stripping off and showing his shortcomings.
You gotta love the 70s. They take it and they're just laughing along with everybody else.
That's the thing. I don't think they would have been able to get away with that today, especially. But back then, it was funny, and they just went along with it.
The host is smiling. He's laughing.
So following David and the crowd chuckling at the entire ordeal, the awards carried out on as normal and finished out the night. So once the ceremony was over, however, who won Best Picture, and it was The Sting, by the way, wasn't the topic of discussion at all the after parties or for those watching along at home. Everyone had only one thing on their mind. Who was that guy that just ran naked across the stage at the Oscars? Now, you might expect that there would have been a big show of having the man escorted out by police and arrested, but that's not what happened.
Again, this is the 70s. Peace and love, baby.
And it was the 70s, but even still, it's very shocking, the reaction, because immediately after running off stage, the man was approached by the awards producer, Jack Haley Jr., given a set of clothes, and asked to come backstage for an interview. The streaker stood tall and proud in front of a massive replica of an Academy Award, a spot usually reserved for interviews with winners and celebrities. Smiling, he told the reporters and cameras, "People shouldn't be afraid to be nude in public. Besides, it's one hell of a way to launch a career." So by morning, the man was being talked about on every news station and talk show host across the country as everyone was dying to know more about him. Robert Opel was his name, and he had America's curiosity in a chokehold as he became a household name within hours. Now, Robert would begin a tour of doing interviews with various talk shows across the country, including the Mike Douglas Show, where he was actually interviewed by Douglas and the one and only Bay Arthur. And if you don't know who Bay Arthur is, Golden Girls.
Is it Bay Arthur or B Arthur?
I think it's B Arthur, but I say Bay Arthur. Throughout all of his interviews by various celebrities, all of them were surprised by how charismatic and charming the streaker turned out to be. He was funny, he was laid back, he was confident, handsome, and above all, passionate about his beliefs with no fear about showing them. During his interview with Douglas, Robert actually joked that the next thing he was going to do following the streaking incident was to run for president, his slogan being, "Unlike Nixon, the world knows I'm not a crooked dick." Which...
that's pretty funny. That's good right there.
It is funny. He had other slogans like, "I have nothing left to hide." He's like, "I already bared it all for y'all. What more do you want?" So he was a good sport about it. He knew how to play into it, make fun of himself.
And he was a good looking guy.
So that's just furthered the fascination with him, because it was like, he's good looking, he's charismatic, confident, and he does not regret doing it. He's like, "Hell yeah, I did it." Now, as the weeks wore on following the 1974 Oscars, Robert continued to give interview after interview, and the world became fixated on his exploits afterwards. People began to realize that although he was only now starting to become a household name, Robert Opel was a very well-known man in the San Francisco Bay Area and had been for many years by this point. gaining a reputation as not only an accomplished photographer, an art gallery owner, but as also a very vocal supporter and fighter for queer rights. So let's start from the beginning and tell you about a man who is truly larger than life. Robert Opel was born in 1939 in East Orange, New Jersey, and he spent the first few years of his childhood moving around from place to place, which included Canada, Kentucky, Kansas, and then finally back to New Jersey, where his family settled in Pittsburgh. Now, raised in a fairly conservative household, Robert spent the first half of his life identifying as a Republican and believing in many traditional values as he went off to college. At college, he was elected to student Congress and served as captain of a debate team. After graduating from college, Robert actually went on to be a speechwriter for the California governor at the time, Ronald Reagan. So any speech Reagan read from, I think it's like 1966 to 1970, Robert Opel wrote that. However, during his time doing this, friends would later say that he became disillusioned with Reagan and the Republican Party as a whole, and that's when he started to move away from it. After leaving the campaign for Reagan, Robert began working as a teacher for the Los Angeles Unified School District, where he taught English as a second language. He held this job all the way up until 1974, where after he was fired from his teaching position following the streaking incident. It was also during this time that Robert became a staunch supporter of civil rights for queer people and began to openly embrace his own bisexuality. Now, Robert often referred to himself as gay, or even would call himself a faggot and wear a shirt with it written across it. So although he enjoyed relationships with women too, Robert felt that during those early years of queer people kind of becoming a focal point in American history, that it was important that people know he enjoyed men just as much as he enjoyed women, and that way they wouldn't try to undermine his love for men by calling him bisexual. So it very much was about making a statement, like, and that still is very much a thing now, bi erasure. You know, you see it all the time on the internet. It's like, I'm bisexual. And then you'll be like, people are like, well, you're in a heteronormative relationship, so that doesn't mean you're bisexual, which is not true. And so that was an issue even back then. So Robert wanted to be known, like, well, he would often call himself gay. He wore shirts with the F slur across it because he was like, yeah, it's shocking and bold, but that's what we need to be in a time like this. And I want people to know that just because I date girls too doesn't mean I don't enjoy a man from time to time. During this time, he also changed the spelling of his last name from O-P-P-E-L to O-P-E-L, dropping a P, in order to be able to separate himself from his family back home in Pittsburgh so they would not receive any unwanted attention from his vocal activism. So on top of all this, he was a very considerate and passionate guy who loved his family, and he was like, they don't need to suffer because of the activism I'm doing, so I'm going to legally change my name to protect them. On top of being a teacher, Robert owned his own photography business called Ideas Photogenic, which heavily focused on homosexual eroticism and nude or sexual photos of various men, and I mean pretty hardcore stuff for most mainstream audiences, which included photo sessions of men fisting each other and climaxing onto one another. His work was featured prominently in the popular queer magazines at the time, such as The Advocate and Finger. He went on to become an editor for Finger magazine and had several columns in it called Around Town and Cruising, which were often tongue-in-cheek, sexually explicit comics with political undertones. He grew popular with many artists and models around the San Francisco Bay Area for his work, with many commenting how he seemed to be the only gay photographer that knew how to balance art with sex, with most being too concerned about the sex part. Robert would remark how he loved working for the magazines, as they were often written by readers, with readers mailing in their sex stories and nude photos of themselves for the magazine, and he just loved the fact that it didn't matter if it was a hetero or homosexual experience, it was just people enjoying sexual experiences together. So he was very sexually free, he loved the idea of people being sexually free, and in regards to the streaking incident at the Academy Awards, there was some slight controversy surrounding how exactly Robert was able to pull it off. Because sneaking into the Oscars was one thing, but being able to sneak in, strip your clothes off, and run out on stage without anyone from security noticing seemed almost impossible. So the biggest question everyone had for Robert was how exactly he did it. Now, Robert was very open in stating that he dressed up and posed as a journalist, before getting backstage and finding a secluded spot where he could wait and not be noticed until the time was right. Once he was ready, he stripped his clothes off and used a knife to cut through the back curtain that separates the stage from the backstage. Now, this seemed like a good explanation to some, but for a lot of people, it was not a satisfying answer. This led to a conspiracy theory surrounding the whole incident, and that many believe the whole thing was actually planned all along and was staged by not only Robert and the awards producers, but by the host, David Niven. So, and of course, we love a good conspiracy theory on this podcast, and this one is such a low-stakes conspiracy that it's kind of fun to believe it. So, for one, the fact that Robert was able to just waltz in, even dressed as a journalist, was hard to believe, since Oscar security is incredibly strict, according to Robert Meltzer, who by that point was the business manager for the Oscars since the 1950s. He stated that he had personally seen multiple people getting kicked out or refused entry for as little as not having the right sticker to park their car. And this included a few little-known actors such as Frank Sinatra, Jennifer Jones, and Joan Crawford. So A-list actors and some who were even there because they were nominated were kicked out or refused entry because security was just that strict. So it didn't make sense that Robert would be able to get in so easily. And on top of that, it was weird that instead of calling police or kicking him out, show producers immediately grabbed him off the stage and whisked him back for an interview. So, of course, again, it's the 70s, baby. It was a different time. Now, to add to that, many felt that David's ad-lib line about Robert was just too quick for him to have come up with on the spot, and it had to have been rehearsed. So, Robert would later explain that by stating he was told David had actually prepared a number of responses to any number of incidents that may occur during the Oscars, which included what would happen if someone streaked across the stage, which again seems very specific. However, this was contradicted by Meltzer and his wife, who stated that just before he went on to introduce the Best Picture Oscar, David borrowed a pen from Meltzer and wrote down the ad-lib he said during the streaking incident. Many now believe that the whole thing was a setup by show producer Jack Haley Jr. in order to get more people talking about and watching the Oscars. To this day, however, no one has ever actually confirmed this, and whether it was staged or not is entirely up for you to decide for yourself.
And I mean, it worked.
It worked. We're talking about it 50 years later, and they're recreating it 50 years later. So if it was staged, it worked. Jack Haley Jr. was a genius. If it wasn't staged, then Jack Haley Jr. is forever in the debt of Robert Opel, because that provided more free publicity for the Oscars than any other millions of ad campaigns. So, yeah, that's one of those low-stake conspiracy theories, whether you want to believe it or not. Personally, I kind of want to believe that it wasn't staged, just because I want to believe that Robert Opel was daring enough to be like, I could really risk getting put in jail for years, but I can always say that I ran naked across the stage of the Oscars, and millions of people at home saw me bare naked.
Yeah, it seems more fun if it wasn't staged.
So that's what we're going with. You don't have to go with that, but we're going to go with it wasn't staged. So following the Oscar streaking, Robert had a bigger platform to speak on as cameras began following his exploits, fighting for equal rights, and being an activist back home in the Castro District of San Francisco. Now, if you are not familiar with the Castro District of San Francisco, it was and continues to be one of the central hubs for queer people to live and be free. During the gay liberation movement throughout the 70s, San Francisco was arguably the number two spot for gay activism, just behind New York City. In the years following the Stonewall Uprising and the start of marches for gay equal rights, over 100,000 queer people immigrated from all over the world to the San Francisco Bay Area. Since many were coming from small towns, it became a beacon of light and hope for all of them, a place where they can finally be out and proud and surrounded by like-minded people. Protests, demonstrations, and parades were commonplace here as we progressed throughout the 1970s, despite pushback from politicians and surrounding communities. Now, as part of his activism, Robert designed and created a full-size costume of a penis, which he called Mr. Penis, to put on and wear to various public events and parades in the street. Now, he was arrested on several occasions and actually banned from participating in several gay-related events. His response to all this was to create a quote-unquote friend for Mr. Penis named Virginia Vagina, which of course was a giant costume he wore shaped like a vagina. Robert firmly believed that part of normalizing homosexuality was for America to get over their weird obsession with seeing genitalia as being bad. Penises and vaginas were things that every person had, and both were seen as being too disgusting or shocking to even be mentioned in public, let alone seen. Which, true, Americans do have a really weird relationship with sex and nudity. So that was his way of trying to help normalize it and make people understand that penises and vaginas are not things you need to be ashamed of. Robert actually had another streaking incident just months after the Academy Awards incident. During a city council meeting to discuss public nudity on beaches, Robert sat in the audience before removing his clothes and walking up behind Police Chief Ed Davis and asking him, "Do I look indecent to you?" before stating that you can be nude, but not lewd. Now, for this stunt, Robert would face some consequences. He was arrested for indecent exposure and found guilty and sentenced to 4 months in jail. After this, Robert's friends would later state that he was becoming disillusioned with how things were going and that he wanted to make a change. Robert continued his photography work and desired to own his own space where he could display his work and the works of others that nobody could restrict or censor. So in March of 1978, he purchased a storefront located on Howard Street in San Francisco, and he opened up his own art gallery called Feiwei Studios, an art gallery that would exclusively showcase gay erotic art. Now, one fellow artist who had his work featured there would later talk about how Robert would decide which art pieces to display in his gallery, and it is a very unique way to do it. So now this part is a bit sexually graphic, so if by some chance any kids are listening, cover your ears. So Robert would have the artist hang his work up in the gallery, and then Robert would drop his pants and masturbate, and he would state, "If the art makes me come, it can be in the gallery." So that is one way to choose your art. Now, with his own space, Robert openly embraced all the graphic and sexual imagery he and everyone like him wanted. He rented the venue out for various hardcore sex parties, including fisting parties and golden shower parties, which, if you don't know what a golden shower is, do you want to explain that to them, Brad?
You pee on each other. It's pretty easy to explain.
It is. Golden shower. And, of course, if that's not your thing, that's not your thing. But it's consenting adults not hurting anybody, and that's what they wanted. And Robert provided them with a safe space to do it without being judged. And that's what he wanted. He wanted people to not be ashamed of their sex, their kinks, their bodies, their genitalia. He just wanted everyone to be free and be happy with themselves.
And by the way, golden showers isn't a gay thing. Heterosexuals also enjoy golden showers.
Absolutely. That's a thing that's enjoyed by everyone across all sexualities and whatnot.
Or not.
Or not.
Okay.
And that's okay. That's the big thing. It may not be your cup of tea. Like we said once before, whatever floats your boat, as long as it don't sink mine. Now, around this time, Robert also met and began a relationship with musician and drag king Camille O'Grady. Now, Camille was a prominent member of the queer punk movement in New York and even opened for a few smaller people that you may or may not have heard of, which included Lou Reed and David Bowie. Now, on top of his work as a photographer, Robert developed a passion for theater and movies. This passion, on top of his vocal activism, allowed him to get close to and become good friends with none other than John Waters and Divine the drag queen. And if you do not know who Divine is, I need y'all to look her up immediately. She's probably the most famous or infamous drag queen in history. You'll see her referenced constantly on Drag Race and in multiple mainstream films. Ursula from The Little Mermaid is actually based off Divine. So she is the literal definition of an icon. You've seen Pink Flamingos, haven't you, Brad?
I have.
Okay. Pink Flamingos is probably her most famous film. That's the one she did with John Waters. Do not watch it if you have a weak stomach, but it is a pretty fun, raunchy time. Now, through Divine, Robert befriended multiple members of the theater troupe known as the Cockettes, a queer, almost exclusively trans theater troupe of actors who made various plays and short films all across the country. And we should probably do an episode on them soon because that whole thing is super fascinating. Robert produced a play for Divine to star in called The Heartbreak of Psoriasis, which was a huge success and helped only catapult him further into fame. On top of that, he produced, wrote, and directed a film with help from John Waters. Now, sadly, not much is known about this film, and it is now considered lost, as the only known prints of it have deteriorated beyond repair. So during this time, he was a busy boy. He was art gallery, activism, stripping, you know, streaking through the Academy Awards.
Having golden shower parties.
Having golden shower parties, making play, like really successful popular plays with Devon, making movies with John Waters. He literally had his hands in just about everything. And all of it was centered around his love and desire to be active and vocal in the queer community and to do as much as he possibly could to make the general public at large see that it's not bad to be queer. It's normal. It's okay to enjoy things. Even if you're not queer, it's okay to enjoy a drag queen or a golden shower. Whatever floats your boat. Now, by 1978, Robert had taken notice and became a supporter of one Harvey Milk. Again, if you don't know who Harvey Milk is, we talked about his amazing life, his career, and his untimely murder back in episode 26. But Harvey was a huge political activist and politician in the Castro District, and he really gave the voice to the queer community. Like, he is often the defining voice of that time period.
Who also met an untimely end.
Yep.
Thus, he's on our podcast.
Exactly. It is a very good episode. It's very informative. We talk about the Castro District history as a whole. Episode 26.
It is a very good episode.
So one day, the very first day that Robert actually met Harvey, Robert walked into Harvey's camera shop on Castro Street, and he asked the clerk if Harvey was around. Now, the clerk by this point knew that anytime a stranger came around asking for Harvey, the answer was always no, because he was receiving constant death threats on the daily at this point. Robert told the clerk that he just wanted to give Harvey something before pulling out a Polaroid. Now, the picture depicted one of Robert's female models posing topless with a Harvey Milk for Supervisor pin pierced through her nipple. So that was his way of introducing himself to Harvey Milk. And I don't think that, perfectly sums up who he was as a person. It involved a beautiful person who was comfortable with their body posing naked, more piercing, you know, like a more out there, you wouldn't really see that, and like it really grabs your attention. So a Harvey Milk pin through the nipple.
He was a shock and awe kind of guy.
He was, and that was his way of getting the point across. And it's kind of like polar opposites. Harvey Milk was very much a play ball with the local politicians, kind of balance, do what they want, and then slowly integrate the queer rights and things like that to make them more comfortable and ease them into it. And Robert's more just like a, just throw it in their face, and if you do it enough times, eventually they're going to get desensitized to it and realize that it's perfectly normal. So two ways to go about it. Both worked to varying degrees. Now, by 1979, Robert desired to somehow grow his display of sexual freedom for people, and to do that, he decided to start his own magazine called Cocksuckers, which on top of featuring all the same sorts of sexually charged photos, would also feature witty and fun comic strips. The first one that was created was called Barry, which was a gay parody of the 1977 horror classic Carrie. In it, a gay boy is teased at school and suffers religious abuse at home, with his mother being portrayed as Anita Bryant. And of course, Anita Bryant was one of the biggest bigots and opposers to gay rights in America. She launched a campaign in the mid-70s called Save Our Children, which helped get a bill passed down in Florida that caused all queer teachers in schools to be fired and barred from ever teaching again. So she was very much enemy number one back in the day on the road for gay rights. Queer people took jabs at her any which way they could, which included drawing her as a raunchy cartoon and throwing pies in her face during press conferences. And if you've never heard the Anita Bryant pie incident, look it up. It's on YouTube. It's glorious. But now, her vocal and bold stance calling all homosexuals pedophiles really helped encourage an increase of hate crimes and homophobic-related attacks all across the country in 1978. San Francisco saw a sharp increase in attacks on gay men, with groups of homophobes oftentimes randomly attacking anyone they even suspected of being gay on the street, in parks, in stores, everywhere. A wave of fear began to wash over the entire community as people became too afraid to walk alone or openly be proud in public like they had been. Now, in response, Robert, who was enraged that people felt like they could just get away with attacking queer people, would gather several large and muscular gay men and all would dress up in women's clothing and drag and intentionally walk the streets in the evening. If anyone began to hassle them or attempted to attack them, they would pull out weapons they had concealed in their dresses and beat them up with them. Robert would later state, "The only way to stop a gay basher is to gay bash them right back." Which, period, that's exactly what you do. Now, this wave of homophobia and bigotry would sadly culminate on November 27th, 1978, when Harvey Milk and gay-sympathizing mayor George Moscone were assassinated in their offices by disgruntled ex-police officer Dan Watt. Now, Dan armed himself with a gun and marched into City Hall, going to each of their offices and gunning them down without saying a word before leaving and returning home. He eventually turned himself into police and admitted to the shooting. Now, of course, the news of Harvey and George's assassination sent shockwaves throughout the San Francisco queer community. Just as things seemed to finally start getting better and they were making progress, their two biggest supporters in the city were viciously murdered. Thousands mourned the deaths with multiple candlelight vigils and services popping up all over the Castro district. Thousands gathered outside of Harvey's camera shop, including Robert, as they paid their respects. Now, all eyes then turned to Dan Watt, the man responsible for the murders. Now, he was charged with 2 counts of first-degree murder, and he went on trial in May 1979. However, part of his defense argued that he had diminished capacity in the murders due to, in part, from eating too many Twinkies the morning of the murder, something he often did not do. The rush of sugar on top of the stress of having recently lost his job caused him to snap. Now, in the end, Dan Watt would only serve 5 years for the double murder. And now this news outraged the San Francisco queer community, and it led to a violent riot known as the Watt Night Riots, where thousands marched through the streets demanding justice be served. Cars were burned, windows were smashed, and in response, police sent task force to the Castro district to perform raids on the gay bars there, arresting 28 people. The following days, more memorials were held for Harvey, and a benefit show was organized and held by Robert, who was looking to raise money to post bail for those arrested and get their charges dropped entirely. The following days, more memorials were held for Harvey, and a benefit show was organized and held by Robert, who was looking to raise money to post bail for those arrested and get their charges dropped completely. Robert called for an end to the cycle of violence that was occurring in the queer community and for there to be peace between everyone. But even if he was calling for peace, Robert wasn't about to just sit back and watch as Dan Watt got to go free and continue to live his life. So after the riots, Robert began to compile as much information as he could about Dan Watt and everything surrounding Harvey Milk's assassination. He kept detailed journals compiling every single piece of info he could find relating to Dan Watt, as his ultimate goal was to use all of it in order to put on a play. Now, according to his friends years later, during this time, Robert and several other people received multiple death threats from people stating that if they didn't stop looking into the Dan Watt case, they would regret it. Now, this did not scare Robert, and he continued to dig as deep as he could. He began to advertise for his new project in all the local newspapers, in which he stated that he would be going down to Civic City Plaza, where he would be dressed as quote-unquote gay justice, and his friend would be dressed as Dan Watt. Once they were there, they would stage a mock execution where gay justice would shoot Dan Watt through the head in front of a crowd. Robert created a flyer advertising this event called The Execution of Dan Watt, with the tagline reading, "What would happen if a gay, queer, homosexual, cocksucker, pervert, faggot shot and killed an ex-cop? Would he get away with murder?" So he made sure to include all the keywords that was shock and grab people's attention. Now, following the promotion of this event, Robert and several people close to him began to receive countless death threats, and they were told specifically by police that they would be arrested if they went through with the demonstration. Robert was told by several people that he would be murdered if he went through with it, but he didn't care. Even after his public information was released by police, and he received more death threats, Robert was unafraid in his stance. Now, this event is somewhat mythical, as you will find no report that can definitively say that it happened or not. There's accounts from people who state that they were there and they watched it happen, And there are accounts from people who state Robert did eventually decide not to do it, only because he didn't want to get the queer community as a whole in the bad graces of the PD. So it's one of those things that's kind of become the stuff of legend. He did plan it. There are flyers. He promoted it. He got death threats from it. But whether he actually went through with it or not is very murky, and we've yet to get any definitive proof that it did or didn't happen. But either way, just 10 days after the flyers stated the event was said to have occurred, Robert Opel would be tragically murdered. That leads us up to the night of July 7th, 1979. That night, Robert, along with his girlfriend Camille and good friend and fellow artist Anthony Rogers, went out to a newly opened club called The Oasis before returning back to the Fayway Art Gallery. The gallery also acted as Robert's apartment and Camille's recording studio, and the three were planning to retire for the night as Robert was actually still recovering from bronchitis. The friends got back to the studio at about 8:30. The three went into the back area of the studio, which acted as Robert's apartment, when the front doorbell rang at about 9 p.m. Robert and Anthony went to the front door and opened the door, where they were greeted by two men. The men walked into the gallery, with one carrying a briefcase that he sat down on a nearby stage meant for performance art. He told Robert either, "This is for or from Dana," before opening the case and pulling out an automatic pistol. The other man standing close by then pulled out a sawed-off shotgun. Both men then demanded drugs and money from Robert that they stated they knew he had. He told them that he had neither and demanded that they leave. Now, at this point, Camille entered the gallery and was forced to the floor by one of the men, who threatened to blow her head off. The man with the briefcase ordered the other man to take Camille and Anthony into the kitchen area of the gallery and, quote-unquote, take care of them. Camille and Anthony were led into the kitchen by the other man, who stole Anthony's camera and took $5 from Camille. Now, he ordered both to sit on the floor facing away from the gallery, but both would later state they continued to hear Robert loudly arguing with the other man in the next room, despite the man continuing to tell Robert, "I'll blow your head off." Camille turned to look towards the gallery and saw the man fire a shot into the ceiling before pointing it back towards Robert. Another shot was fired, followed by a shattering sound, although Camille continued to hear the man and Robert arguing. Finally, a third shot was fired, followed by the sound of a loud thud hitting the ground and then silence. The man with the briefcase ran into the kitchen and told the other man, "Kill them both and let's get out of here. There's a crowd gathering." So, of course, by this point, the neighbors and other tenants of the building had heard the commotion, and many had started to make their way to the gallery to see what was going on. As the man with the briefcase fled, the other man proceeded to tie Camille and Anthony's hands and feet together before telling both of them they will die if they ever identify the robbers, before he too fled the building. Now, once they were sure both men were gone, Anthony and Camille untied themselves before rushing into the gallery to find Robert lying on the floor in a pool of blood, barely alive and breathing heavily. They quickly called police, and Robert was rushed to a hospital, where he would sadly die from his wounds not long after, having actually suffered being shot through the head at point-blank range. He was 40 years old.
What a waste. Look how much he'd done in 40 years.
Yeah, and can't even imagine what he would have continued to do if he had gotten to live a long life. And that's the sad and tragic thing, too, is these people that are this vocal, especially during this time, because, you know, again, this is the first decade of the gay rights liberation movement, so tensions were still really high. Homophobia was very open and almost expected of you. And so these people were really putting their lives on the risk daily to just be who they are and be vocal and proud about it. But at the same time, they didn't care because their ultimate goal was to help the community at large. And almost there was a sense of, I'm fine if I die at some point. At least I know I died doing what I think is right and I know is right. And so sadly, like Harvey Milk just a year before him, Robert's life was tragically cut short, and in the most senseless way. Now, once brought in for questioning, Camille was not only able to provide detailed descriptions of both men, but she did them one even better. She had actually worked as a sketch artist in the past and was able to draw very detailed sketches of both men down to certain marks and freckles on their skin. The sketches were released to the public, and within 2 days, police arrested two men, Robert E. Kelly and Maurice Keenan, in connection with Robert's murder. Now, Maurice's girlfriend at the time, Linda Holt, was also arrested as an accessory to murder, as she admitted to being the two's getaway driver the night of the murder. When questioned about motive, Kelly mentioned that the whole thing was set up by a man named Dana Coleman. Now, Dana is a name that was very known to Camille and to Robert. He was actually a shady character that had recently started coming around the art gallery and hanging around. Now, although he seemed like an all-around nice guy, Camille would later state that she always had a bad feeling about him, and that on several occasions, he had sold drugs and pills to Robert. Robert was someone who always saw the best in people, and he never seemed to mistrust anyone, and he always welcomed Dana with open arms. Now, Dana had actually called Camille the night after the murders and told her, before any police sketch had been released, that the guys she was looking for are named Robert and Maurice. Both men would later state Dana had been the one to tell them that Robert's art gallery was in fact a quote-unquote drug den, and that he was hoarding drugs and money. Dana, however, denied all this. Maurice admitted to being the one that actually shot Robert, and both Maurice and Robert were tried and found guilty of first-degree murder, with Robert being sentenced to life in prison and Maurice being sentenced to death. However, that was later committed to life in prison. Linda Holt had her charges dropped due to lack of evidence. So now, although on the surface it seems like a pretty open and shut case of a senseless robbery gone wrong, Robert's family and some of his friends aren't so convinced. Several of them believe it is kind of too convenient of a case, and that it is possible the entire thing was a setup by a disgruntled police officer or two who hated Robert, of course. For one, Dana Coleman was a very well-known police informant and had only seemed to start coming around the gallery after Robert's public announcement about the mock execution of an ex-cop. On top of that, when his family were given a box of evidence containing all of his belongings from police, they found that officers had actually written the word homicide across the box. Now, although officers tried to play this off as just being a joke, of course his family did not find that funny at all. So there was the theory that some of them believe and still believe that it is possible police officers, at least some of them, didn't like how vocal and how pushy Robert was. You know, they've never experienced a queer person that fought back as much as he did. So it's possible they may have told Dana to set up the whole thing and have the robbery staged and have one of them kill Robert. Now, of course, none of that is substantiated. That is just a theory. And to this day, no actual evidence of a conspiracy has ever been found, and Dana Coleman was never charged with anything. Robert's studio has since been turned into a storage facility for a restaurant, and it bears no resemblance to the former Fayway studio. Robert was buried in a family cemetery where he is often visited by his family to this day. Now, although it's been almost 50 years since his passing, Robert's memory continues to live on through his loved ones, and he will continue to live on forever as the man who ran naked across the stage at the Academy Awards. And that is the story of the Academy Awards streaker, if you didn't already know. So that is the man they are talking about last week at the Oscars.
And that was just a very small thing after you hear everything else that he'd done. Running across the Academy Awards, of course, that is very public, and he got a lot of press for it. But everything else he'd done, like, I mean, he led an amazing life for it to only be 40 years.
And that's the thing, too, is, like, of course, even when I first heard about it, I just heard about he was the Academy Awards streaker. And then when you actually look into it, he did so much in such a short amount of time for the queer liberation movement. And that's something I think is important to remember. And that's one reason I really wanted to go ahead and do this episode. Because, of course, he is the Academy Awards streaker, but he's so much more than that. And so I think it's important that everyone knows that although that may be his most defining stunt he ever pulled, he did so many important and passionate things for the community that he cared about. He put his life on the line. He didn't care to go to jail. He didn't care if he looked like a fool in front of people. He was passionate about what he believed in. He wanted to make sure everyone else knew that. He wanted to help progress queer rights as much as he could, and he wasn't afraid to do anything to do it. It was very in your face. And so I think that's just one of those things, like, he had his 10 seconds of fame as the Academy Awards streaker, and that's what it'll always be known as, and probably forever. But
honestly, he used that fame to his own benefit and everything else that he was actually passionate about.
And that's part of it, too. It's like, he was already a very vocal advocate before that, but he even said it helps launch a career, and it really did help put him in the spotlight and it helped give him a much bigger platform to speak on the issues that he cared about and was passionate about, especially queer rights and, you know, freedom, sexually free, freedom people, trying to make people realize that they shouldn't be afraid of, you know, their kinks or being sexually liberated and stuff like that. And so he was just a very all-around interesting and fascinating person to read about. And it's just such an interesting life to live in just 40 years. And he will continue to live on as the Academy Award streaker. And with that, thank you guys again so much for tuning in for another episode. Hopefully next week, I will be completely drained of whatever it is that's stopping me up, and I'll return back to normal. Until then, if you enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a 5-star review or rating on iTunes or Spotify. Helps us out a lot, helps other people discover the podcast. And of course, we just love hearing your guys' feedback, whether it be bad or good, but hopefully it's good. And if you want to see photos from this case, you can follow us on Instagram at Beers with Queers Pod, that's P-O-D, or on Facebook at Beers with Queers, a true crime podcast. And until Monday, stay dangerous out there, my friend.
See you soon.
Bye.